Thank you all for coming out on this lovely day. I'd like to simply at this point introduce the Dean of Arts, Chris Manfredi. I'd like to congratulate him as well on his recent announcement of his recent appointment as Provost of the University, and he will introduce our main speaker, Dean Manfredi.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Will. Je suis ravi d'être ici aujourd'hui de vous souhaiter la bienvenue à la conférence Fulbright. The McGill Institute for the Study of Canada has hosted Fulbright lectures since 2006, and the Fulbright scholars have helped in raising MISC's profile locally as well as in the United States. The Fulbright program offers MISC an annual visiting chair focused on public policy and fields of mutual interest to Canada and the United States, in order to further the development of MISC's program and research. The major benefits that the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada realizes through the Fulbright visiting chair are the intellectual value of integrating a dedicated researcher into ongoing areas of scholarly pursuit, the increased public visibility the Institute gains by having noteworthy scholars addressing issues of current debate and importance, and the long-term benefit of ongoing academic ties with the United States in areas of mutual interest and concern. Today we have with us Brad Hector and Michelle Phillips, who are representing the Fulbright organization. Mr. Hector is responsible for the Fulbright Chairs Program, and Ms. Phillips is Fulbright's new Program Officer for Outreach and Alumni Relations, and I want to ask you to welcome them with us this afternoon. I would now like to formally introduce this year's Fulbright Visiting Research Chair in Aboriginal and Indigenous Life and Culture in the North American context at McGill University, Dr. Margaret Moss. Dr. Moss received her PhD in nursing from the University of Texas at Houston Health Sciences Center in 2000 and subsequently completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Colorado's Native Elder Research Center, a resource center for minority aging research. Concurrently, she entered and completed law school and received her Juris Doctorate from Hamline University School of Law in Minnesota. In 2008-2009, Dr. Moss was named a Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellow and staffed the Senate Special Committee on Aging. Also in 2008, she was inducted as a fellow into the American Academy of Nursing. Dr. Moss is Hidatsa with equal lineage in the Fort Peck Sioux tribe. In addition to her research on aging and health disparity, she currently teaches nursing at Yale University. During her tenure as the Fulbright Research Chair, Dr. Moss has examined how science, law, and health policies collide in Canada's Indigenous people with the aim of identifying where the most immediate challenges to health care provision and health status tracking can be mitigated and how it may be achieved with revision of care and related laws. Here to present this year's Fulbright lecture, Counting on Care, Canada's Challenge in Tracking and Reporting Aboriginal Healthcare, is Dr. Margaret Moss. Dr. Moss.
Thank you, everyone. Just going to get to my slides here for just a moment. Okay, and it is my pleasure and honor to be here as a Fulbright chair here at McGill, down in Yale. When I was looking at this, so I said, oh, it's the Harvard of Canada, how exciting. So I got Yale, I got Harvard, I'm done. So anyway, yes, I am an American Indian from North Dakota. And I'll speak a little bit to the fact that we say Indian and you don't say Indian up here and so forth, that I'm not being disrespectful in any way if I do throw out Indian, because that's just what we say down there and it's the actual legal term. So I'm going to go ahead and start with this. First, I'd like to start with the acknowledgments for Fulbright for administering and choosing me to be able to be on this experience. And for McGill itself, and especially MISC for housing, where I've been doing my look at this issue, and at Yale, of course, for letting me be on sabbatical and come up here, so that's great. So I have a couple slides on my experiences in Canada, just to let you know. I am a total neophyte in Canada. I know nothing of Canada, so this has been a huge upswing for me. It's been a big learning curve. So just the simplest things. When I went to Ottawa for the orientation for Fulbright, just interacting with the other scholars, chairs, and students, I learned several things that stuck with me and helped to inform what I did here. One of them was learning about this report called Beyond the Asterisk. Has anybody heard of this? I think it's in the field of education, but it could certainly be moved to healthcare, which is, we always say, I don't know, but we don't know about First Nations, but we don't know about Aboriginals, but we don't know, and there's always an asterisk. And I usually point this out when I'm in America as not hitting the charts. So when I go to the big scientific conferences, you know, and down there, of course, we use different terms, but white, black, you know, Hispanic, maybe Asian, other. It never quite hits the charts, anything about American Indians and Alaska Natives, which is the combined term to talk about the people in the 48 contiguous states and Alaska. I also learned about Stolen Sisters. Has anybody heard of this documentary? Just fabulous. We're having the same problem in the U.S., and I'll speak to that later in this presentation, but the abysmal kidnapping, assault, and murder of indigenous women. It's going on in the U.S. epidemically, and then it's also going on here. And somebody had made this documentary, of which I'm going to show just a 1.5-minute clip just to introduce you to it. Also was able to go to the Supreme Court, understand again that indigenous law is taken care of differently and under different courts and so forth from things that happen in the provinces. Again, it's another complication. Same in the U.S. There's complicating laws, you know, jurisdictions, and so forth governing natives. And then I was struck because you'll see one of the topics I'm going to be talking about here is the invisibility of the people, both in America and here. And so just being in Ottawa and walking around, I saw so many Aboriginal people. I can't tell, being very new here, whether they're First Nations, Inuit, and I don't know, Métis, I don't know how you say that. But anyway, they were obviously Aboriginal people. And I was able to talk to just some other, you know, other scholars and so forth in my groups, and I said, wow, there's a lot of Aboriginal people just out on the streets, and they're like, are there? They didn't notice. I mean, everywhere we went, and I also like to acknowledge my husband, but dragging him around to Ottawa and everywhere, but we noticed them, you know, in their cars, selling things on the streets, just walking by everywhere. I was stunned at how many, and other people would say, oh, are there? So that stuck with me. And then learning about Killam, which I'll bring up in a bit. So these are just some of the experiences. I don't know if you can see that or if it's too small. But I just wanted to make it clear that those were some experiences by having a Fulbright orientation. And then the experiences I've been able to have here at McGill and through MISC, just a variety of topics that were extreme interest to me. The first one being the Indigenous children's health issues and the jurisdictional problems there, you know, who's in charge, the province, the federal government, and what are the barriers, and, you know, widening and closing the law and so forth. That was of great interest to me. And then this Killam lecture, one of my areas of methodology is in GIS mapping. I was so thrilled to see this, and here I just learned what a Killam was when I went to Ottawa for the Fulbright thing. The reason I use GIS mapping for my area of American Indians, even though we have 4 to 5 million, depending on how you count it, versus the 1.4 million here, the percentage is much lower. It's less than 1% in America, and it's 4% here. So even less visible. But if you take 4 million people and put them on a map of the U.S., suddenly you can see them. You couldn't see them on those charts, but you can see them on a map with the dots. So I really have embraced the cartography area. And I was able to go to the, and I'm not even going to try to say that, but the homeless program for the Aboriginals. And that is a program that I was very interested to find out about. It seems to be working fabulously well. Has anybody been to this program or know anything about it? it's for the homeless in Montreal, Aboriginals. And I was just thrilled to see a program that worked. They don't turn anybody away. It's growing. Just wonderful. They're adding services all the time. This isn't something that you see in the larger cities in America. For instance, I lived in Minneapolis for many years. It's in the top 10 of urban centers for American Indians. There's not very many programs for people. So I was thrilled to find out about that. And then I was able to seek out the School of Nursing director and see what's happening in Canada, what are the trends, what are the issues. So that was also a great contact. Was able to meet with Dr. Weinstock of the Institute of Health and Social Policy. One of the other areas that I usually focus in is social and structural determinants of health, and his program there has that as a backdrop. And then I was able to see a talk that they had there on users. What I liked, what struck me in the materials that went out, was they were talking about tracking health care and fixing it. Not in any way having to do with Aboriginals, but I thought, well, if this is a mechanism that they're using to focus and track what's going on, who needs care and why, who's falling through the cracks, any information we can get will help. And then I was able to go to the Ganawaki, even though it's a K. That was fabulous. I just sort of tagged along with class here and was able to see their longhouse and hear quite a bit about an overview of their cultural issues and so forth. Hope to return to go to their cultural center and then hope to visit the Friendship Center. So it's just been a whirlwind. It's been very fast and just a wonderful experience. So I thought that I would just talk a little bit about those terms, just a couple of seconds here. In the U.S., we use the words American Indians and Alaska Natives as one thing. Again, the contiguous plus the Alaska. We also use Indians just as shorthand for that. Native Americans is more popular culture. And if we use the overall term, it's usually indigenous. Now, the reason that I use American Indian is because we aren't Indians, as I know people say here in Canada too, but we are American Indians just because that's the way it's been for several hundred years now. You know, you can't fight City Hall and all that. But Indians is the legal term in America. And so we found that if you don't say Indians, money, funds, different things can get rooted places you didn't want it to go. So you have to be very specific as to who you're talking about, which is why we stick with that word in legal realms. So in Canada, I've noted since I've been here, I didn't know this before I got here, that Indian is a more of a derogatory term and that you don't use it. You do use First Nations and then the Inuit and Métis. But of interest, in both countries, Indian is the actual legal word. So First Nations is not the legal term. So I'll probably go in and out, and when I speak off the cuff, although I'm going to try to stick to my script here, I may say Indians. Don't take it in the wrong way. That's just my perspective and the way that we discuss it. South of the border, I guess. So a little background of this inquiry, and then I'll get into this, which was, as stated, I was a Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellow. That's where they take health, mid-senior career health professionals, place them in the U.S. Senate so we can inform them. This was during the health bill there of 2008-09, and then we can learn legal processes and legislative processes and so forth. So I was there in that time, and I was able to come up to Ottawa in 2009 as one of the Congressional Fellows, which is the larger group. And we were able to have be at the table with the Minister of Health and the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, among other people. And at that time, since we were working on the health bill down there, you know, national health, I asked, since we kept pointing to Canada, saying they have a national system, they have it, they have it, they have it. And so I said, well, to these people, how's your health disparities? You know, since you have a national health program, and the ministers, and again, I don't remember who they are, but said, and or his office, that the health disparities are still not good here, that there are still are health disparities for people of what we call, and I'll address this later, people of color and so forth, there are still health disparities. So I kind of locked that away. And then when the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs came through, I asked the same thing. They said, no, you know, health is not good. It's not, the status is still not good. So I took that back with me just because at the time I'm working on health bill stuff. I had, you don't know what you hear in America, but everybody says you didn't read the bill. Well, it was my job. I had to read the bill. So I'm thinking, okay, the point of this is to fill in for most of the people who don't have health care. That's a lot of your people of color, immigrants, and you know, international, and all sorts of people. But if it's a country up here that has it, and they still have the same disparities we have down there, I don't get it. So that was one of my questions, is that even though we have two countries that are side by side, wildly and widely differing health systems, histories, geographies, politics, and so forth, hugely different, you know, Indian policies, so forth, and yet the exact same outcomes at the other end. How does that happen? So that was one of the things that drove my inquiry to look at how data is gathered. What is the spirit of your census and statistics law saying you're supposed to know where is everybody, what condition are they in, you know, how many are there, and so forth. And then the Health Act, which says everybody should have access to health based on need, especially, and not around the ability to pay, and yet these huge disparities exist. So that's the kind of thing that I was looking at. So I will start now here. And if I was in America, and speaking of American Indians, I could speak off the cuff for hours, believe me, and I have. But since this is Canadian and I had a huge learning curve, I am going to refer to my paper quite a bit, so I don't want to get any of this wrong. So, for Canadian Aboriginal people, health disparities persist tenaciously and steadfastly in a country that embraced the idea of health care for all 3 decades ago. To the South in the U.S., health status numbers for its country's Indigenous people are no better. American Indians suffer huge gaps in health disparity as compared to all other races, and the lowest average life expectancy rates in the Western Hemisphere. Although the principal aim here is not to make a direct comparison of U.S. and Canadian Indigenous persons, it is hoped that stepping back to view both at points along a historical gradient will serve to better understand how each country arrived at the health status outcomes we see in 2014 for Aboriginal or Indigenous persons. So, let's see. I don't have a clicker, so I have to... So there were similar beginnings, differing paths, and same outcomes, which is one of my driving questions here. Why? During the years of first contact of what was to become Canada and the United States, Aboriginal peoples and their respective nations were viewed as governing sovereign states with whom it was appropriate to make treaties. The people were seen as citizens of their respective nations. It was recognized that they held inherent knowledge of place and inherent sovereignty, at least at that time. In Canada, there are treaties continuing through the 1800s with Aboriginal people. Some of these are referred to as the numbered treaties. Of these, number 6 in 1876 was the first to refer to health care in any way and stated, quote, that a medicine chest shall be kept at the house of each Indian agent for the use and benefit of the Indians at the direction of such agent. The same treaty speaks to assisting in times of pestilence and famine. In the U.S., in the mid-1800s, the roots of federal Indian law were being formed through the Marshall Trilogy. Is anybody familiar with any of this? All right, I'll just give the quick overview. Couple sentences. These three Supreme Court cases introduced the ideas of tribes being one, domestic dependent nations. Number two, to be viewed as wards of the federal government. And therefore, three, the federal trust responsibility was formed. This trust relationship includes the provision and administration of health care for American Indians and Alaska Natives. So this was the basis of federal Indian law in the U.S. early 1800s, still in force today. However, across North America, sustained colonial contact and contact with the newly formed U.S., wars for dominance and political doctrines designed to, quote-unquote, get rid of the Indian problem persisted. And I see that quote in both countries, getting rid of the Indian problem. Has anybody heard of this? Okay, that's... The view of who these first peoples were changed fiercely. In what was to become these North American countries, indigenous sovereign nations and their citizens now became less than people, their nations less than sovereigns, less than and different than, in an ultimate us and them, laid the groundwork for the near extinction and manifested itself today in today's health disparities. There's a whole body of research talking about this, which I'm not going to go into because that would take another 2 hours. suddenly my head just, what was that? Quick, Willie, what is it? Oh, suddenly I can't remember. It'll come back. But anyway, there's a whole body that goes along with that, and the name just went out my door. All right, so what I'm going to talk about now is health indicators, because again, I'm looking at treaties, histories, and so forth, laws, current laws, plus this past view. In terms of health, it could be looked at in terms of a million things, but my area is health. So population numbers and trends over time are one indicator as to the health of a people. Although it is important to recognize that North America's indigenous people did not represent a cultural nor genetic monolith, they certainly were the first inhabitants, and the population count, is guessing at this global aspect. The numbers of these first peoples vary in the historical telling, with estimates from several million to numbers up to 18 million across North America. Is anybody familiar with that number? Are you surprised by it, or did you realize? Many estimates go even as high as 20 million. I'm being a little bit conservative there. That is a lot of people. So this is across North America, but above Mexico and pre-contact. Of this number, estimates for Canadian Aboriginal people, pre-contact or at contact, run from a low of about 200,000 to 500,000 to a high of 2 million. By contrast, estimates for indigenous people across Canada, the U.S., and Greenland totaled only 375,000 in 1900. Does anybody realize that it went that low? It's just horrendous. A high of 18 million to almost nothing. So putting it in stark pictures like this helps me to understand what problems of counting are really all about. If pre-contact population numbers represented an Aboriginal population zenith, then the nadir came in the U.S. at the turn of the century with a census count of about 90,000 people. So you can't even see that line on the U.S. over there. 90,000 from about 15 million people. It's just horrendous. This was a stunning reversal due to exotic illnesses, warfare, forced marches, migration to unfamiliar and unforgiving environments. In Canada, population numbers for Aboriginals similarly fell, so that by 1867, only about 112,000 to 138,000 remained. And as with the U.S., the Aboriginal population of Canada continued on a decline until the turn of the 20th century. To date, neither country has returned to the healthiest estimates of pre-contact. There are only about 2.5 million federally recognized American Indians in the U.S. and 4.5 from the census. Again, in the U.S. census, it is self-reported. So that's the difference. I'm still unsure if you have those differences here. I know you have status and registered and non-status and a lot of determinations as well. But the 2.5 are those people who are members of their federally recognized tribes and able to have Indian health services and so forth. So I want to talk a little bit about who are they in the first place. Who are these people we're trying to count? If we don't know who they are or where they are or anything else about them, how are we going to know about their health care provision, or their health status? How do we count the people? When referring to Aboriginal people, the terms themselves can be quite confusing, as I just ran through right now. For instance, although First Nations is widely used to describe the Indigenous people of Canada, excluding Inuits and Métis, the legal term is still Indian. Did people know that First Nations is not the legal term? As recently as 1920, the Deputy Superintendent General of Indian Affairs, Duncan Campbell Scott, is to have stated, "Our object is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada that has not been absorbed into the body politic, that there is no Indian question and no Indian department." Even more recently, 1951, the legal definition of a person in Canada was, quote, "someone who is not an Indian," unquote. Has anyone heard that before? In the U.S., an Indian is only an Indian if Congress says you're an Indian, and it's by the sufferance of Congress, an actual legal term of art, that the tribes exist. Being Indian in the eyes of the U.S. government is a political, not a racial, determination, and therefore one's Indianness can be legislated in or out of existence by the whims of Congress. There are further conventions to measure what Indianness is by the use of pedigrees that are kept by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the form of blood quantum. And I don't think I have gotten that far here. Are there blood quantums in Canada? Do people count that? Okay, I wasn't sure. I myself and my four children have papers listing our blood quantum. Without such a paper, one is not an Indian in the eyes of the federal government and not do any services, such as health care, through the Indian Health Service. Indian Health Service is a federal health program for Indians in the U.S., but is funded only at 50% of need. In fact, less than half the dollars per person are routed to American Indians than to health care for federal prisoners. Aboriginals in Canada are not a visible minority. And again, this is sort of my perspective from the outside. I know you in Canada have different terms and things, but this is one that just kind of struck me. In the United States, the term people of color is often used as an umbrella for non-white or mixed race ethnicity persons. This includes American Indians, i.e. indigenous persons, as well as all other persons of color originating elsewhere, exotic by definition. Having such a term is a double-edged sword of sorts, and we recognize that. On the one hand, it perpetuates the us and them nature of viewing people, where in this case, white is the standard or the default, and then there are people of color. On the other hand, using theories of cultural competence, especially where healthcare is concerned, until we can see differences, presumably politically, legally, and in a regulatory fashion, as well as in our individual and community lives, nothing will ever change, and change it must. In Canada, the government has a distinguishing term for non-whites. This is the visible minority. It was largely put into place for employment regulations vis-a-vis discrimination. However, the definition clearly states that a visible minority is someone who is not an Aboriginal. Again, it's one of these backwards definitions of what an Aboriginal is not. But it offers no further explanation. Excuse me. The history is then that Aboriginals were not persons. And to become a person, or at least not Indian, they must be absorbed into the body politic. So once absorbed, they are not white, nor are they a visible minority. And absorbed and invisible appears to be a theme. Even when one chose to remain an Indian, and this is the terms from before, about 30 years ago, you probably are all more well aware than I am that if a female married outside of her race, that she was no longer an Indian. So just by marriage, suddenly you're no longer an Indian. With these legacies to overcome, how does Canada successfully execute laws governing counting, quote-unquote, the people via the Statistics Act, which I've been carrying around, and protect the residents purportedly of Canada, purportedly people of Canada, via the Health Act? A question to be considered is, are Aboriginals in North America, north of the U.S., Canadians? Do they consider themselves Canadians? Do Canadians consider Aboriginals Canadians? And what messages or signals are being sent by either group in this regard? This exploration is specifically looking at these ideas in relation to the health of Aboriginal people. Such fluidity of self and person in regards to being Native no doubt underlies the fluidity of data. I'll talk a little bit about health. As I undertook this project, I did so with disparity in health, poor health status, and gaps in care for Aboriginal people as a given. My inquiry was why, in the face of the Health Act and the Statistics Act, legislated to know who and where people live and assuring access to care for all, especially for those in need. No people are in greater need by population than Canada's Aboriginal people. The aim for this talk is not to give a comprehensive picture of those statistics, rather examples of statistics that in their gathering or reporting may aid in the difficulty in tracking and using actionable statistics for improved health outcomes. The health status of Canada's Aboriginal people falls far below the average health status of other Canadian inhabitants. Whether looking at life expectancy, maternal and infant health and mortality, chronic diseases such as diabetes and health, heart health, or infectious diseases such as tuberculosis or influenza, and asthma, the numbers are shockingly disparate. Add to this a major public health concern, outshadowing many others, that of violence, and some of the most urgent, inexplicable, yet unaddressed health issues come to the fore for Aboriginal people, not just in Canada, but across North America. Life expectancy falls 9 years less for males and 6 for females, where for other Canadians it is 79 and 83 respectively, and you can find various numbers within that range. Here is one of the first caveats and numbers that I noted first in the U.S. In the U.S., numbers such as life expectancy for American Indians and Alaskan Natives are similar, though not quite as high, late 60s to mid-70s. But one needs to drill down into Indian country, onto the reservations, and into areas that are in greatest need on every measure. On the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, a male born in 2014 has an average life expectancy of, who's got a guess? Anybody? Chickens? Okay, it's just under 40 years old. This is in America today, South Dakota. This is not the lowest in Indian country, the U.S. or North America. This is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere, tying with Haiti. But the numbers that are reported belie this desperate fact in the plains of the U.S. In view of the numbers in Canada that mirror those in the U.S. for Indigenous, I would suspect that regional, population-specific numbers need to be reported and re-reported for action to occur. Infant health is a widely accepted indicator of a population's health. In Canada, these numbers are gathered by the provinces and territories with no consistency around this indicator for Aboriginal infant mortality rates. However, one can see when listed by regions, that those territories that have high Aboriginal populations, such as the Northwest Territories, Nunavut, I don't know, and the Yukon Territory, that infant mortality rates skyrocket. What we cannot see are the proportion of Aboriginal people and the numbers for the provinces. Diabetes numbers are reported to be 17.2% among First Nations individuals living on reserve, 10.3% for those off, 7.3% for Métis, as compared to 5% in the non-Aboriginal population. As in the U.S., the numbers are over triple those for all races, U.S. Using a similar approach for life expectancy and infant mortality, some tribes, such as the Pima, have the highest rates of diabetes in the world, 10 times those of U.S. all races. Some added issues are higher rates for gestational diabetes for Aboriginal people, earlier onset of disease, and poor outcomes, including amputation, dialysis, and death. Tuberculosis had largely been wiped out and or greatly contained in the 20th century. And yet, in the 2006 census reports, Aboriginal people, who make up only 4% of the Canadian population, represent 21% of TB cases. I was stunned at that one. Similarly, although it's reported differently, the TB rate in the U.S. for Indigenous people are at 750%. So 7.5 times versus 10 times. So the rates are far. One of my points and discoveries is it's just as bad, U.S., Canada, and yet somehow the paths were so different, politics so different, governing so different, yet the same horrible outcomes. So it just became more and more apparent the more I looked into this. Suicides are double the general population. In both Canada and the U.S., with numbers slightly higher, actually, in Canada. But numbers alone, again, do not show the trends. Bimodal versus unimodal, for example. Has anybody heard of this in regards to suicide? So what I found in the U.S., apparently it's the same here, is that for Indigenous people, people kill themselves young, teens, even 12s, preteens, and then into like their 40s and 50s. But elders don't kill themselves. So that seemed to be one of my questions when I was investigating down in the U.S., and it has a lot to do with culture, returning back to, you know, spirituality, religiosity, whatever you want to call it, and finding, if you believe in certain aspects, that killing yourself is not going to save you your grief. In particular, I studied with the Zuni people in New Mexico. And they felt you have a path. If your path was supposed to, that you die at 80 and you killed yourself at 60, you didn't let yourself off for 20 years, you're going to be bothering your relatives and yourself and you're uneasy and whatever till you should have died anyway. So they don't kill themselves because they figure it's not getting them out of anything. Anyway, interestingly, and I don't know if it's the same reasons, it holds true here. Whereas for the dominant culture, there's a bimodal suicide graph. Kill yourself young in the teens, early 20s, and so forth, then nothing, and then elderly kill themselves. And so that's a complete difference again. But when you just give raw numbers, and that's all you have, which are bad enough, you don't understand the trends and the modalities, so then how are you going to make interventions? So again, this is horrifying. The gray is the dominant cultures in Canada and the U.S., and the blue are double, that's for Aboriginal, and then Inuits are just literally off the charts. What do we do about that? Here's one of the problems that I've been alluding to. This is from one of the reports that I got this from. Just showing that there's no good way of collecting this data, or there is, I shouldn't say there's no good way to do it, no good way has been found to date, I suppose. So what I'm saying here is different places gather the information on different age groups, different genders, at different times, during different, you know, spans. Nothing is uniform so that you can then not draw conclusions again. So data gathering, which is one of the main things I was looking for, and tracking and making sensible, actionable statistics out of Aboriginal health care. This is just an example of one of the problems. Now, violence, I'm almost there. Violence is something that I felt that I really had to bring out. For the last three decades, it's become recognized as a public health problem. Included in this category, of course, are homicide, violent assaults, rapes. In the U.S., it's been a top 15 leading cause of death since 1965. For American Indian Alaska Native women, and we just talked about suicide, homicide rates are 10 times those of the next closest group. Who has anybody heard that? American Indian and Alaska Native women are murdered at 10 times the rate of the next closest group. It's stunning. It's earth-shattering. And yet you don't see it in, you know, New York Times or the you know, LA or whatever. One of the places that I found it was Al Jazeera. You should look into Al Jazeera. It reports quite a bit of indigenous people, oddly enough, but the major media outlets in the U.S., and I haven't really looked here, do not report on this. One in three will be raped. One in three have been or will be raped, American Indian women. And again, remember the population is 5 million. That's a lot of women. I was able to befriend the chief of the Mohegans since I've been in Connecticut because, as it turns out, she's a nurse. She told me a story of she went to the plains somewhere in the middle of the U.S. I can't tell you which state, to a meeting with other chiefs and so forth, and they were discussing this issue. And they had some young girls in groups and so forth there. She and another chief overheard a little girl group here, like 12 to 14-year-olds, discussing, well, when I get raped, blah, blah, blah. Not if, but when. So again, how do these people worry about getting an A in math or, you know, doing the dishes or keeping, you know, safe and whatever? If this is the kind of thing you have to think about all the time, and nobody is coming to the rescue. They just have to think about it for themselves. 80% of perpetrators in the U.S. are non-indigenous males, and few are ever prosecuted. In the U.S., there are many reasons for these high numbers, many of them having to do with complex jurisdictional authorities around major crimes. So there are, if someone murders, there's complex, and they've been there since the 1800s, if a non-Indian comes in and murders and rapes on a reservation, Indians don't have authority over non-Indians, and so, you know, off they go. Or if they can prosecute someone, Indians tribes only have the authority to hold someone for 1 year. So you can murder somebody and get 1 year. The federal government has the authority to prosecute, but you're in the middle of North Dakota, you know, what's going to happen? They never, almost never, get prosecuted. States have also another complication of Public Law 280, where they can prosecute for major crimes. But again, there's such tension between states and tribes, a lot of this stuff never happens. So after a rape, murder, and so forth, either a tribal police, federal police, state police may all become involved, but sadly, in many cases, none become involved. In Canada, the numbers for violence, especially against Aboriginal women, are also high, but with different patterns for their perpetrators. Oh, sorry, missed something here. So I wanted to ask you this little question because I didn't know it, but maybe let's see as a show of hands. How many people know who John Martin Crawford is? Anybody have a... All right, so I'm going to show you this little clip. This is what I learned in Ottawa from one of my scholars. is this documentary on Stolen Sisters. I don't know if you can read that at all, but basically, in 2004, Amnesty International made a bold pronouncement, and it wasn't about Guatemala, Saudi Arabia, or Guantanamo, sorry, or other global hotspots. It was against Canada. Canada is putting indigenous women in danger of kidnapping and violent deaths through racism and indifference. It is estimated that over 500 Aboriginal women have been murdered or gone missing in violent circumstances in Canada in the past 20 years. This is literally a 1.5 minute clip that I thought I'd play.
This issue of missing First Nations people in general, not necessarily just women, has been a low, low priority of government and society in general. I spoke to some very high mucky-mucks. I asked some questions. Do you know Clifford Olson? Do you know Paul Bernardo?
Yeah, he's a famous murderer.
Paul Bernardo is a murderer.
Mass murderer.
Oh, he's that awful man who committed all those murders in Ontario.
Clifford Olson is a child killer.
Serial killer.
Clifford Olson is a serial killer.
Everybody in the hall, about 300 of people, raised their hands, and they were very pleased that they knew these serial killers and criminals, and asked the question, do you know John Martin Crawford?
I have no idea who John Martin Crawford is.
I don't know.
I don't know.
No.
I don't know John Martin Crawford.
I have no idea who John Martin Crawford is. Sorry.
Nobody knew him. Why?
He is a bona fide serial killer. The general population doesn't know about him. The media doesn't seem to have a great deal of interest in him. I believe the only thing that's different, particularly in the case of Paul Bernardo, is the fact that John Crawford's victims were Aboriginal women. Paul Bernardo murdered attractive young white women. Society cares.
This is a person that killed three Indian girls here in Saskatoon. So what? So who cares? Just another Indian. Not even thinking that this person is a mother of somebody, a daughter of somebody, a friend of somebody.
So I just want to bring that out again. If nobody cares and that idea of invisibility, how are we ever going to count? How are we ever going to get these accurate counts as to who needs help? So I just have a couple more just quick slides, I think. One, again, I did look at the Statistics Act because I have done census work and so forth, both in the Senate and with some research, and so I have this interest in Senate as it pertains to doing what it's supposed to do in regards to either aging, which is what I looked at before, or Aboriginals and so forth. So what it says is it's supposed to collect, compile, analyze, abstract information for relating to commercial, industrial, financial, social, economic, general activities, and condition of the people, which I find stunning. To collaborate with departments of government in the collection, compilation of activities, and again, we know that there are Aboriginal affairs and other government entities that interact in Aboriginal health, to take the census and to generally promote and develop social and economic statistics pertaining to the whole of Canada. Statistical issues for Aboriginals can be examined from a basic indicator, such as infant mortality, or from another more problematic indicator, suicide. But statistics seem to be failing in many of these areas. In Canada's Health Act, I just wanted to pull out one thing I read, which was that the Canada Health Act relies on federal spending powers to establish a Canada-wide, publicly funded healthcare system that bases patients' access to healthcare services on need, not the ability to pay. In the Act, there is a definition of insured person, which means in relation to a province, a resident of the province. This Act came about in 1985, or 3 decades ago. A first-ever strategic plan geared to First Nations came out in 2012. And it says in it, over the last 6 decades, there have been many milestones that have contributed to better health outcomes for First Nations and Inuit. Unfortunately, their health status, as measured by most major indicators of health, remains below that of the Canadian population, unquote. This statement sounds, when I talk about signaling and messages, sounds, especially to me as an outsider, as though the Canadian population, one, does not include Aboriginals. And two, in view of the history of the word person in regard to Aboriginals, taken together, one would surmise that they only recently rolled this out with the Act. That is, being a person. Only a person in the 50s having this Act in the 80s. And only in 2012 have a strategic plan around this and comparing Aboriginals to that of the Canadian population. This is problematic, as they certainly fit the spirit of need in view of their gaping health disparity. But as we know in the U.S. and other countries with conquered indigenous people, it takes longer than decades to overcome these policies and definitions. So I'll wrap it. I had talking points so I could elaborate or not, but we're running out of time. So I just want to make this point. And we see this a lot in the U.S. in terms of funding. I told you that Indian health services are funded at half of need, half. So if this is Aboriginal health, I don't know, can you see that? The shortest boy, and the general population is the tallest boy. By talking about equality, which is one thing a lot of us fall into, if you give everybody $10, they're still in the same gaping disparity. But if you give pointed help, assistance, looking at sustained action, money, and so forth, you will finally lift up that little boy. It is equity that we need, not equality. Equity in health. So here's my last, I think. So for strategies, these are just sort of things I noticed. I'm not sure what that is. But notice the invisible people, the people beyond the asterisk. Then move past admiring the problem. We kind of get stuck in the U.S., I notice, admiring the problem without taking any next steps. Carry out the letter and the spirit of the law. If it says you're supposed to look at the condition of the people, all people, gather information on all people, and interact with other departments for the condition and help of all people. I mean, it's already on the books, but it doesn't seem to be completely being done. Same with the Health Act. And from that very first slide I showed you, talking about the children who couldn't get the care because of legal and jurisdictional barriers that's been going on for decades, just need to carry out the letter and spirit of the laws already on the books. Use actionable statistics by attending to the things I talked about. Look beyond just the global, oh, they're okay, they're within a few years of our life expectancy, without looking at the really bad numbers. Apply those tenets of health equity and not equality, and make this a huge priority. So that's all I have for now. And if there's any questions.
Thank you very much, Margaret. We have time for two or three questions because we have another very important event that's attached to this one, so I'm happy to moderate. I only have two simple rules for questioners. The question needs to be in the form of a question, and there's one question per customer to start with. So if you have questions. You can go to the microphone or just be loud. Actually, maybe better go to the microphone so the cameras can pick it up. I just got the thumbs up from my friend in the back with the camera. So.
Okay. Thank you for your talk. My friend and I were from the Faculty of Medicine, and we were just wondering, because we get a lot of lectures on Aboriginal health, and it's a lot of, like what you said, admiring the problem, not doing much. Do you have any guidelines, any recommendations for how we as future health workers could help address the problem?
So when I run across this in the U.S., you know, there have been many, many research studies on all this to admire the problem. We've moved now into interventions and so forth. Tribes themselves come up with interventions, but a lot of these things just sort of sit on the shelves, you know, once we're past getting the grants and so forth. So I guess the translational aspect of it, the intervention aspect, is what is next and what really needs to happen. But even before that, my problem is the statistics that from even the studies that have been done often are being masked by these global overviews. So picking apart the statistics even that we do have first, and then seeing that on Pine Ridge you're dying by 40. It's not 75 if you looked at the global numbers. So starting to pick past that is what I would suggest. Okay, thank you.
Don't run away. Don't run away just yet. Anyway, Dr. Moss, I want to thank you for spending the time with us at MISC for your talk today. Thank the Fulbright organization for supporting it and continuing to support the Fulbright Visiting Scholars Program at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. And I'd also like to present you with a small gift in our appreciation for all of your work.
Thank you so much.